Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 53 for June 8th, 2010. I'm Dominic Rabia, and with me today are...
Ben Snickoff.
David Liu.
And David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. Google pulling Tetris clones from Android Marketplace, the AP and the Shepard Fairey case, and movie downloading subpoenas. We'll start off with our first story, Tetris clones on Android. The Tetris game, which... has been pretty popular for several decades now, had many clones, about 35 or so, in the Google Android Store for App Store. Is it called an App Store for Google?
Yeah, it's the Android... I think it's
Android
official
Market,
called the Android Marketplace.
The...
Yeah, Marketplace, okay. But it's an App Store.
Anyway, so there were 35 Tetris-like games in the Android market, and the company, the Tetris Company, as they're called, that owns the rights to the trademark Tetris... and licenses the name to other parties, they sent a DMCA takedown notice to Google, and Google, upon receiving this DMCA takedown notice, removed these 35 games from Android Market. What's interesting about this case is that a lot of these games didn't use the Tetris trademark. They just were used similar gameplay elements, but they never used the word Tetris, and they never didn't use any artwork from the original game that would have been copyrighted. They just used the same gameplay mechanics. The Tetris Company's reasoning was that the games that were removed didn't fall under literal trademark infringement, but rather fell under trade dress, which is protected by the same part of the law called the Lanham Act that trademark law comes under. So I guess the question we have, to start off our discussion, is the Tetris Company right in using trade dress to remove games that merely share gameplay elements with its classic Tetris?
Well, first thing, I hate not answering your question, but the first problem that I see is that even if they are alleging that it infringes trade dress, they shouldn't have sent a DMCA takedown notice because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act covers copyrights and not so much trademarks or trade dress.
Right. So then if they use the wrong... mechanism, why did Google take it down when they got a DMCA notice for a trademark trade dress violation?
I mean, I don't think Google's really in a position... officially, the DMCA takedown notice is appropriate. You know, it says, we are Tetris Company LLC, we own a copyright in the Tetris game, and, you know, these are the registrations, and we think the following things infringe... are infringing on our intellectual property. And, you know, if they hit all of those points, I don't think Google really has a choice as to whether or not they should take it down according to the DMCA. The question is whether or not the people who put those games in the store should counter notice and say, one, you know, we're not infringing copyrights. Two, this is bogus and I'm going to, you know, sue because you guys willfully, you guys sent me a, knowingly sent me a incorrect... takedown.
And a counter notice would allow them to do what?
It would just allow Google to put it back up on the Android marketplace, and then at that point Google wouldn't have to fear being sued by Tetris. The counter notice gives the person whose content was taken down a way to get it back up online and a way to protect the third party, the service provider, from legal action as a result of continuing to host allegedly infringing content.
I'm going to jump in here, though. I mean, I'm really uncomfortable with the idea that a DMCA takedown notice was actually sent in lieu of like a cease and desist letter, which is something that is more likely to have been used by, I guess, other lawyers. That's pretty common in the practice to send a cease and desist letter to a company that might be misappropriating your trademarks or if you have reason to believe that there's a trademark issue there. That said, I mean, I guess there still might be some copyright issues here as the Tetris Company sees it, but based on this article that we're reading, it sounds like this was pretty clearly based off of trademark law. And the problem that I really find with the DMCA in using it for a trademark issue is just that the DMCA is all about copyright law. It has nothing to do with trademark law, but we are dealing with an issue here, which is you have the Google App Store, which is hosting content which is being uploaded by third-party developers, and because of that, maybe you have an argument similar you know, to the way that the DMCA works with shielding liability for those types of third-party uploads, user-generated content, in other words, with respect to, like, the trademark claims here. But it just the Act doesn't apply to trademark law, so I don't really see how it should be used. I mean, you might be able to make some analogies between the two about why we should have a statute that's similar to the DMCA for trademark law, but we don't right now.
But is that the problem of the DMCA, or, I mean, should there just be another law? I mean, it seems weird to misappropriate the tool in that way.
Well, you know, I don't, it's really hard to speculate on what these lawyers were thinking here, but based on the way that the Act is wording, there doesn't seem to be any affirmative right on the part of Google to take down those apps which were posted, which the Tetris company claims are infringing their trademarks, just because the DMCA applies to copyright law, not to trademark law. Maybe what has happened here, though, is that the Google guys are treating this more like a cease and desist letter, and they're concerned that there's going to be some sort of secondary trademark liability, and there might be some sort of colorable legal claim underneath all of this, under which the Tetris company could then sue Google on top of suing the people who actually wrote these applications. But, you know, there are still problems with the trade dress claims underneath all of this. I mean, trade dress law by itself, which is what the Tetris company is apparently claiming here, is being violated. You can't protect functional aspects of trademarked items with trade dress law. And it's not really clear, it's not clear to me because I haven't looked at all these different applications and what they actually look like, how similar they are in terms of the color, the shape, and those types of things to the program that the Tetris company created years ago. But that said, I mean, the game code is very functional. You're not protecting that under trade dress law. You're actually protecting the ornamental features, really, of the way that the game looks. And that would all seem to be somewhat limited because there are functional aspects to all of those things. I mean, that's how the game works. You have these little shapes which look like, you know, L's and plus signs and squares and those weird ones that look like a Z that I hate to get. And, you know, that's how the game is played, and so it's a functional part of the game. You need to have those shapes, but that wouldn't be protected by trade dress law.
Right. The trade dress here would really be the overall design, you know, not of the play elements of the game, but, you know, the main screen with a gray background and a next box to the side and offset slightly down and the color scheme of the entire thing. And, you know, it may even extend so far as to the music itself or the type of music. You know, maybe you can sell a Tetris clone, but you can't use the music. What? It's some Russian music. It's from something famous, isn't it?
Yeah, so actually some of those I think are public domain works now.
I believe but it's the Beer Barrel Polka.
Okay, but the fact that it's public domain wouldn't change the fact that you could assert, at least I think you could assert a trade dress claim, you know, with regard to using that song in conjunction with a, you know, game, a falling tile game where all of the tiles are consisted of four parts.
Thank you, David Liu.
I think that was Dominic, wasn't it?
It was me.
Very nice. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, that's something that would definitely classically fall under copyright law, especially if it's some type of adaptation of something that is either a public domain work or something that was actually licensed for use in Tetris. But I suppose you could apply an argument that trade dress would apply there. I have always just mentally associated it more with color and shape and other distinctive features that really make an item get that secondary meaning, which you have to have also. You know, it always has to pop into your mind and associate, you know, that particular type of color, or maybe it's that music if we want to go this far and say that music is included under trade dress law, and immediately then in my mind I've got the picture of just Tetris.
The name of the song actually is Korobniki. It's a Russian folk song about an incident between a peddler and a girl haggling over a price. Incidentally, Apple has also removed a Tetris clone from its app store, citing, without even a DMCA reason, they just said it's too similar to Tetris. I guess that's kind of quasi-trade dress?
Yeah, that's a weird kind of thing that Apple does sometimes. You know, they've been known to take down applications because they mimic too closely functionality that Apple already has implemented, although they've been turning back on that recently, toning down that behavior.
Isn't there from the non-legal perspective here, if I see a game with 4 falling blocks into a column where I try to make lines, won't everybody call that Tetris? Is that somehow grounds for confusion of brand, trademark, so to speak, or not?
I mean, what you're essentially arguing is that any game that has, you know, blocks of 4 that, you know, fall down and, like you said, to make lines is... You're saying that Tetris is a generic term for falling block games. You can make the argument, I think, that that's not the case, that Tetris has a strong enough brand and has done enough to protect the brand over the 20 some odd years that it isn't generic for falling block games, especially because we're now describing them as falling block games and not all of them as Tetris.
I mean, I think it's a pretty unique game. I have not really seen the term Tetris overused to apply to, you know, a generic set of games. I think the closest game that I actually remember from my childhood, I think, was Dr. Mario. That was pretty similar to Tetris, but it had the falling pills, you know, to match the colors.
From my understanding, though, of intellectual property law, like, you can't just protect the idea behind a game. Like, you can protect the art, you can protect even particular... Then obviously the name, but like you can't protect the concept behind the game. There's nothing stopping me from making a Monopoly clone game that is very similar to Monopoly, uses completely different names, uses a different layout of a board, although the same mechanics, uses different concepts. Perhaps I'm collecting planets or stars. I mean, that...
Well, you can certainly copyright the rules as you've written them, but... And
right.
Traditionally, you're right, though, the functional aspects of items like games and art and other types of creations are generally not protected under trademark law or copyright law. That's all within the realm of patent law.
What this reminds me a lot of is all the hullabaloo that went on around Scrabulous back last year, or 2 years ago, whenever it was, in that they had essentially created a Scrabble clone on Facebook, and Hasbro did not like that. And it almost seems like we can use, you know, the technically legal Mad Libs to come up with these stories so that we have, like, on fancy new technology platform, third-party developers have created a version of some popular thing, but company name doesn't like it, so they sent them a takedown notice. And, I don't know, I feel like the same thing would happen if you made a Monopoly clone.
On the iPad, cloned, or never mind. I was going to try playing your Mad Libs game, but no such luck.
I had one thing. Yes, I do. And that's earlier, David O'Brien, you mentioned that, you know, maybe Google was treating this as a cease and desist and, you know, took it down kind of preemptively because they didn't want to be subject to any kind of trademark litigation. Why is it that something that amazingly we have not talked about recently on the podcast, Section 203, if I'm getting that right, of the Communications Decency Act, why doesn't that protect Google from liability for trademark infringement? Like it 230. Why doesn't that protect Google from trademark infringement like it does from libel suits?
It doesn't pertain to intellectual property laws. Section 230 is all about non-intellectual property laws. So there's perhaps an argument, I think I get what you're getting at here, and that's... trademark law was actually not created under the Intellectual Property Clause of the Constitution. It was created under the U.S. Commerce Clause, part of the Constitution. And because of that, some people say it's not quite intellectual property law, but it's pretty close to it. I think that I'd have to look back into this, but I do think that the Communication Decency Act does not apply to claims under trademark law. Well,
it doesn't apply in intellectual property law and federal criminal liability. Those are the two things that are made as exceptions in the actual statute itself.
So, Ben, did you have anything to add to that? Were you going to make an argument?
No. I just wanted to get that out there as to why Google would be concerned about taking down infringing third-party trademarks.
Oh, okay, I got you. Yeah, I mean, so the thing I brought up about the distinction of whether or not trademark law is actually intellectual property law, I mean, for all practical purposes, absolutely it is. But, you know, there for international intellectual property law issues, especially with respect to certain treaties and stuff, there are major distinctions drawn between trademark law and copyright law and patent law. So that's all I was talking about.
All right. David Liu, did you have something to add, or are we all set?
The only thing I have left is just curious if any of these games have a chance of making it back onto the Android market. I mean, just general predictions, not legally whether they can.
I mean, if I were one of these people, I would send a counter notice and then probably send some sort of claim letter or legal threat to Tetris saying that they sent a knowingly false DMCA notice to Google that took down my... my app, and then I'd, you know, send them another sheet of paper that says normally my sales are this much, and over the time that my app was not on the store, I probably lost this much in revenue. I say totally go for that, but as far as whether or not any of these people actually will, I don't know.
Assuming you have one of the generic Tetromino games and not the Tetris-named ones.
Right.
Right. The other thing that you mentioned, David Liu, is about the Scrabulous dispute. If you think about the phrase Scrabulous, it's obviously very similar to Scrabble. So you've got more of a trademark claim there. And they had the same issues in that case with respect to trademark claims and copyright claims over the actual Scrabble-like game that was being played over Facebook and wherever else. So that case was pretty distinct from this one, although... it would depend on like the name that people are using to describe it. Something like Tetronic, that might be a little bit closer for trademark law, just for confusion on the mark. But with trade dress, it seems like this is sort of a tenuous argument in some circumstances. And you know, as Ben said, I would think that there's a good argument to keep those games back up there. But it's up to Google too if they want to keep these things in their app store.
Just a quick side note before we move on to the next story. The people behind Scrabulous, I believe, now have an application on Facebook called Lexulous, which is less of a trademark, and I believe also has slightly different rules than Scrabble. Like, I think you have 8 tiles, and the letter distributions are slightly different, I think. But
so. Yeah, and the bonus squares are in different places.
All right, well, should we move on to our next story?
Yes, let's.
We shall. David?
So our next story is all about the Shepard Fairey case. It's kind of an update, but I don't know that we've really talked about it very much on this show, mostly because it's, doesn't quite fall into the realm of what we would consider technology or internet law issues, but it's still pretty interesting. And this, of course, involves the iconic Obama Hope poster, the Hope picture, that was pretty prevalent throughout streets, on stickers, on people's T-shirts. I think everyone pretty much saw it everywhere, and actually especially on the internet, too. And it pictured Barack Obama on a photo with, that was, not on a photo, I'm sorry, it was a redrawn picture, and it had blue and red and some little intricate designs within his face. Underneath it, of course, in big letters, it said, Hope. Well, during, and this was, of course, circulated all throughout the 2008 presidential election, and it turned out, as we got closer and closer to the election day, the Associated Press, or the AP, they started making claims that they, in fact, owned the photograph which was used to actually make this drawing, and that they had not given any permission to the person who made the drawing of the Hope poster, whose name was Shepard Fairey. And this poster was so famous that even after the election, I think there's now a copy of it that's hanging in the Smithsonian Museum. There's a number of different works from Shepard Fairey that are related to this Obama campaign that he worked on that are being displayed at museums around the country. So we're talking about a pretty famous piece of work here. And in order to sort of get back at the AP, Shepard Fairey filed a lawsuit, and he was seeking a declaratory judgment, and those are, of course, the lawsuits that are like suing people so that you don't get sued, and he was seeking the court to declare that his work was not infringing. And the big issue was whether or not this photograph, and it was eventually determined that the photograph that the AP owns was used to create this new poster, which is Hope, which was hand-drawn, created in a day, whether or not that was an infringing piece of work with respect to the AP's copyrights. And the news that came out this week in this story is that apparently the court, and the lawsuit was filed in the Southern District of New York, the court has come out and said that he suggested that the parties go ahead and try to settle if they can, because he believes that the Associated Press will eventually win in this case. So there's a number of interesting issues here, of course, with fair use type stuff, and there were some other factual issues that are pretty interesting. I don't know if you guys caught those that we can discuss. Who has any initial thoughts on the Hope poster and whether or not it's actually infringing?
I think it is infringing because it's a derivative work of a copyrighted photograph.
I think regardless of whether or not it's a derivative work of a copyrighted photograph, it falls fairly into the square use exception.
The square use exception.
Fair use exception.
All right, so I think you guys have just hit the two biggest points in this. Dominic, why are derivative works important, and why is this a derivative work?
Well, derivative works are one of the copyrights that are protected by the Copyright Act, and this is a derivative work because he based it off the photograph. His sketch was based off the photograph, so it's derived from that picture.
Yeah, other examples of derivative works are things like sequels, and depending on how you go about it, a cover version of a song may or may not be a derivative work of the original.
It does not matter the type of medium that the derivative appears in, as long as it's a copyrightable medium, is that correct?
That is correct. Yep. So a derivative work of a novel could be the movie based on that novel.
Or a painting based off of a photograph.
Right.
Right. We could come up with 100 things that fall into this category. Okay, and what about the fair use issues here, Ben? You brought that up.
Right, so I concede that, you know... Actually, a brief note on a side issue. Shepard Fairey initially said that he did not use this photo in making his work, and it was, in fact, a different photo. He then backtracked on that and said, you know, yes, I, in fact, used that, and I was lying earlier when I said that I didn't. Meanwhile, the AP is engaged in a side fight with the photographer of that, photographer of this subject work, because the photographer says AP doesn't have a right. They don't have the copyright in that. I think there were summary judgment motions on that, or summary judgment motions on that issue are, they either were due in the past or they are due very soon. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that side issue plays out, because, you know, if the AP ends up not owning copyright in that, it kind of changes the whole metric of the AP versus Shepard Fairey case. As for, you know, fair use, I mean, we've beaten these fair use factors to death recently, but essentially we're looking to the purpose and character of the use, including whether or not it's commercial. In this case, Shepard Fairey said he's made virtually no money on this. I'm sure that's changed, but, you know, underlying it was political speech, it wasn't commercial speech, so that weighs in favor of Shepard Fairey. You look to the nature of the copyrighted work, in this case it was a photograph. The amount of it used, you know, they used part of the photograph, but it's difficult to kind of gauge who that weighs in favor for here, because the derivative work, the Hope poster, was so different fundamentally from the photograph, you know. Yes, you kept things like the gaze and the angle that we were looking at Obama from, but, you know, very little of the underlying photographic data, if any, was kept in the, you know, Shepard Fairey's work. And finally, it's the effect on of the use upon potential market or value of the original copyrighted work. And my guess is AP's argument here is going to be that, you know, there's a robust market for properly licensing these works, and, you know, AP makes it very easy to go and get licenses to do these things, and Shepard Fairey just didn't do that. So he would have had to obtain a proper license, and that's the effect on AP's work here. You know, I don't know how much I buy that argument. It's also hard to tell how much of an effect that actually would have had on AP. You know, would everyone had to have gotten a license for this every time they reused it? You know, if that's the measure of damages, why don't we just, you know, measure those damages and find somebody to pay up, as opposed to having this fight about whether or not it's fair use or not.
And Dominic, I think you take the opposing viewpoint on this, right?
Right. I think it's a derivative work and it doesn't fall under a fair use exception. So,
do you want to address any of those particular factors that Ben discussed? Because I do really think that this is a very close case when you look at it. You know, you have almost an exact copy of Obama's gaze. There is very little that is different other than the fact that the Obama poster was hand-drawn. There's colors added to it and a couple little pieces of artistic detail here and there. As compared to the original photograph, I mean, those elements, the underlying elements which were taken from that photograph, almost appear to be exact, with the exception that the color was added. There's some little artistic things, and of course the big hope wording down at the bottom. So is there anything that really stands out to you, Dominic, that might change any of those factors?
Sure. I think we have to really look at factor number two, the nature of the copyrighted work. What is the original underlying work? And that's a photograph. And what makes this photograph so poignant? It's the way the president looks. Like, it's the gaze. It's not the background elements. It's not so much the coloration. It's just the photographer caught Mr. Obama in a particularly poignant pose. And that's part of the art of good portrait photography. You gotta get your subject in a place where they're looking interesting and looking good, and he got that picture. Mr. Ferry then took that poise, and then derived his artistic transformation on it. From my perspective, it's almost as if he just ran a Photoshop filter on the original photograph. Now, he didn't just run a Photoshop filter. He did add his own creativity. He did transform the work somewhat from one medium to another. He added the words hope. But the fundamental aspect of the copyrighted work, that gaze, remained.
I'm going to actually go with Ben here and say that it's derivative, just because I don't think if you had taken the original photograph by Mr. Garcia and stuck it on a poster with, let's say, even just the word hope below it, so leaving the photograph as is, that it would be as successful and iconic as it was. You know, sure, it's a Photoshop filter now, and there's websites where you can do this now that makes this transformation, but I would say that the amount of value added by Mr. Ferry is substantial, and that, you know, sure, you could claim that, or you know, I guess the AP would claim that they could make, you know, X million dollars from licensing that image. But at the same time, I think if Mr. Ferry hadn't used the website in this, or hadn't used the photo for this purpose, then, you know, it would be just another one of millions of photos of Obama. But I'm sure there's a legal problem with my argument there, and I'll leave it to you guys to point out which one it is.
No, it was an interesting argument, and I don't know that it was necessarily legally flawed, because there isn't a black-and-white answer when it comes to fair use. That's something that the judge has to determine. But one thing that I want to point out, and that's that a lot of the articles that I've written are really interested in how popular the Hope poster was, and how everybody, I'm sure that almost everybody in the country, eventually saw one of the Hope images at some point, with this exact one with Obama's face on it. And they're pointing to the fact that, you know, this was a historic election, and this was widely circulated. And as Ben pointed out, these were actually sold in the beginning. I think he sold at least several thousand posters for about $45 a piece. But as far as I know, those proceeds were actually used to continue printing up more posters. And by at least one estimate, I think I read in a court document, of course, this was written by one of the parties, so I don't know how accurate it actually is, but I think they said 300,000 posters were eventually distributed for free. So it widely distributed, and there might not have been a huge effect on the market, but at the same time, just because that this was such an iconic poster, that doesn't give you license to use somebody else's copyrighted work, and just because this was so widely circulated and stuff. As far as the fair use factors go, though, maybe Ben has pointed out one of the most significant things, and that's because this was political speech, and because that a lot of these posters were distributed for free, the effect on the market probably wasn't as significant as it would have been if this was a distribution of something more commercial. You know, if every poster was being sold for $45 and there was a lot of profit that was made off of it, you know, that would definitely change the fair use factors. But I think that the biggest problem is still that you have a pretty close copy of the work. And it seems to be copying the heart of the work. I mean, the photo was supposed to, it was from a 2006 conference, I believe, and it was supposed to be all about Obama, and as Dominic noted, that he's very well framed in the photograph, and, you know, it was a product of good photography, of good creativity of the person taking the photo. Interestingly, though, the photographer has already said that he didn't care that his photo was used. And as Ben noted, he is disputing who actually owns the copyright, whether it's the AP or the photographer himself. And the argument probably there is whether or not he assigned his copyright in the course of taking that photograph and submitting it for an AP story. So we'll have to see where that goes. But certainly that issue would be outcome dispositive if it fell in favor of the photographer who took the original photograph. And also the other interesting thing here is that just the judge is encouraging the parties to settle, but he does seem to think that the AP has a stronger case here overall, and I think the briefs for summary judgment are due in early July, and so it could be that the parties will not settle, and this will still go before the judge on summary judgment motions, but I guess we'll have to see. Does anyone have any additional thoughts that they want to add or arguments?
There are two quick things that I want to mention. The first off, well, I guess just one thing now. The biggest problems that Shepard Fairey is going to have going forward are, you know, the repercussions from having started out this litigation by lying about the source of the photo. And as a result of this, I mean, we still haven't seen all of the effects. He's going to be precluded from introducing certain evidence in the case. You know, there are going to be a lot of sanctions that could, in the end, seriously affects his ability to defend himself and assert his claim of fair use.
And it's not just lying. According to this article, it says he also destroyed evidence and created false documents to make it look like he got the source from somewhere else initially.
Right.
Oh, and one other thing I read was that he's being investigated by a grand jury for perjury because those statements he made were statements under oath. But that would be with regard to a criminal action related to this case, not this civil action between the AP and Fairey.
The one other fun fact that I'll add is that Manny Garcia, who took the original photo, also took another iconic photo of the previous president, and that's the one where he's looking out the windows at Hurricane Katrina damage.
The one with the gently, you know, grasped fist, you know, angry at what happened to New Orleans, that one?
Yes, Ben.
Okay, thank you. I guess I've got the last story here. So we've mentioned before that the U.S. Copyright Group, a consortium of law firms, banded together and purchased the rights to bring litigation regarding copyright infringement on file sharing services like BitTorrent. And they specifically did this with the movie Hurt Locker. They had sent out a series of demand letters, and they were trying to ascertain the identity of a lot of these file sharers, and they have recently filed suit. I think it was three suits with a total of 14,000 defendants, so they filed these John Doe suits just like the RIAA did, where they, in this case, they're filing suit in Washington, D.C., and they're saying, you know, we're suing these people and we don't know who they are, so court, please let us, you know, subpoena the internet service providers, the ISPs that have this information so we can get it. And it's kind of annoying to have to find representation in Washington, D.C., to try to quash these subpoenas. So what the EFF has done is filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, on behalf of the people who are the subjects of these subpoenas. And essentially, they're asking for the Washington court to quash the subpoenas, to get rid of them, arguing that it's really inconvenient to defend these, and that it's unfair to bring, you know, in this case, you know, one of these suits is, you know, U.S. Copyright Group versus, or you know, the Hurt Locker Company versus John Doe's 1 through 5,000, and the EFF is arguing, you know, you can't sue 5,000 people who are engaged independently in, you know, essentially unrelated activity in one place that has, you know, no bearing with the actual infringing activity that happened. And as a result, you should, you know, quash your subpoenas and make them refile them in places that make sense to actually litigate these cases. Anybody have any thoughts on the merits of the EFF's argument in this case? Or need me to explain in more detail? Did I get across what's going on here? Is anyone confused at all?
No, I mean, this sounds like it's a venue dispute at this stage of where the first pleadings have been filed. Is that correct?
If only that were the case. So typically, what David O'Brien is mentioning is, let's say David Liu files suit against me in St. Louis for something I did in Massachusetts. He was here in Massachusetts. Let's say he was, you know, he slipped in my kitchen and fell. So he's now suing me in St. Louis, you know, over his slip and fall in my apartment in Massachusetts. What I would be able to do, you know, once he filed that suit is find some lawyer in St. Louis to file a motion that basically says, this is absurd. You know, for one, you don't have personal jurisdiction over this, over my client. You know, the court doesn't have any power over me because I'm not in St. Louis. You know, I haven't been in Missouri in almost a year now. I've got really no connection with that state. I'd also be able to say that, you know, the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, or, you know, that, you know, you can't prosecute a tort case in St. Louis for a tort that, I mean, sometimes you can, for a tort that happened in Massachusetts. But a better argument would be that it's improper venue, that, you know, the better place is in Massachusetts, where, you know, there were two witnesses, where the subject property is, where the thing actually happened, and it would be a lot easier to prosecute the case in Massachusetts, and it would be a lot more convenient for me. That's not what's happening here. So those are essentially the arguments that the EFF is making, but they're making it at a different stage in the litigation. This isn't one of the actual defendants saying, you know, you should dismiss it and they should refile it somewhere else. This is the EFF saying you should quash a subpoena, which is, you know, an evidentiary gaining device. You know, it's kind of a type of discovery. You know, we're just trying to ascertain information. The EFF is saying, well, if you want that information, you should have gone somewhere else to get it.
What are their chances of success?
That is a good question, and I don't really know. So typically, these arguments are not these arguments are frowned upon in at this stage. You know, this isn't really the proper time to be bringing up venue. However, a court may be, you know, may be willing to consider it just because you're dealing with 5,000 unrelated defendants, you know, 5,000 people who have never talked with each other, who don't know each other. The only thing they have in common was that they were engaged in a similar activity on the internet. It's difficult to say that that has any of the hallmarks of things that, you know, can be brought together in one suit according to the rules of federal rules of civil procedure. David Liu, from your perspective, I mean, is there even like a fairness thing? Like, it doesn't seem fair that these people should be sued somewhere where they've, you know, possibly never been. You know, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, regardless of my personal opinion on illegal file sharing, like, it is still illegal. And so, I mean, it seems
I
like
prefer the term
you're.
undocumented file sharing.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. No, but the. I don't know. It seems like there's a certain level of gray area here in between, like, you know, oh, it's so inconvenient for me to do this, whereas, I don't know, there's not a coherent point there other than I could see BP, for instance, saying, oh, it's really inconvenient for us to be prosecuted for spilling oil. I mean, really inconvenient, so let's not.
There's a difference between inconvenience of the thing itself and inconvenience of where it's taking place. You know, it wouldn't make any sense to sue BP in Alaska for an oil spill that's taking place in the Gulf. You know, none of the relevant people in that case are in Alaska. All of the relevant people are related to BP and on the coastlines of the Gulf that are now, you know, inundated with oil, and the people, the fishers who, you know, fish in that area who now have, you know, upwards of a fifth of the Gulf of Mexico blocked off as, you know, places where you can no longer fish. The problem, imagine if this were some crime, like David Liu in St. Louis, you spray paint something on a street sign, so you're a vandal. The fairness issue is not whether or not it'd be fair for you to be prosecuted for spray painting that sign. It's whether or not it'd be fair to make you travel to Texas to prosecute you for spray painting a sign in St. Louis, and it wouldn't.
Yeah, it's inconvenient for very specific reasons. So I was just keying on that one word as an excuse, and it's not. Is there any real question here, though, on the fact that this is the U.S. copyright group and not, like, the studios bringing the suit? I mean, how does that play into the situation here?
If I remember correctly, was this the group that got assigned all the copyrights?
I'm pretty sure that...
litigation?
Right. I'm not sure the details of that. It looks like, looking at the EFF's amicus brief, that there's a real defendant, I'm sorry, a real plaintiff here that isn't the U.S. Copyright Group. It's very much in German. Achte, neunte, eight, nine, Boll Kino. I don't know what Boll means, but Kino is movie theater. Some sort of German company that owns the rights. I don't know how that group is related to the U.S. Copyright Group, though.
Number Wang? Anyhow, I think what that the U.S. Copyright Group is just another consortium of attorneys and probably people that seek out IP file share. I mean, people who are file sharing and possibly violating copyright laws. I'm sure that there's some sort of agreement between the ultimate copyright owners and the U.S. Copyright Group in this case, whereby the U.S. Copyright Group can pursue the litigation, and you know, there's file sharing and whatever. Profit sharing, not file sharing. They can get the whatever profits they derive from the litigation, they'll either share or distribute, keep for themselves. It all depends on the agreement.
Okay, any last thoughts on this, people? We'll start at the top of my list here. Dominic.
All set.
DRO.
No, not really. I mean, I kind of feel the same way that you seem to feel, Ben, and it's really difficult to go into a court if, say, you're a California resident, and it's really difficult to go into a court in Washington, D.C. to try to defend yourself, and you always have to worry that if you don't make an appearance, then you might be found to be, the plaintiff might get a default judgment because you didn't show and win the case on default grounds. So there's that concern, and the other concern is that, you know, a lot of file sharers, of course not all of them, appear to be young people, so they don't really have a whole lot of money in order to defend themselves. So another thing that would make it difficult, I could imagine a number of college-age kids or high school kids who maybe over the age of 18, not, you know, their parents aren't helping them out, but they get one of these notices to appear in court in D.C., they can't afford to do it, and just decide not to go. That's something that could hurt you a lot in the future, even if you don't show up to defend yourself. The default judgment will hang over you, and at some point people will come after you looking for money. So all those things are concerns, and we'll have to see with respect to what the EFF has filed here whether or not that will be successful.
Okay. David Liu, any last thoughts?
All set.
Okay. In that case, I would like to thank you all for joining us this week on the Technically Legal podcast. As always, you can find us at technicallylegal.org or Twitter. Our screen name is at TechLegal. You can please read our blog, download the podcast. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, please email us podcast@technicallylegal.org. So signing off, I'm Ben Snakeoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for joining us.